We'll pick up the countdown shortly here, and H-minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Cut, Quantel, opt in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. Coming to you on the 21st of May in the glorious future year of 2022. A pre-recorded show today because I hope to be at the anime club meeting. Although, I might give up that idea because of the high price of fuel. It's about an hour's drive to get over there, and I can get within a couple of kilometers by train, although the schedule isn't very good on Saturdays. So, suffice to say, it takes a while. I suppose I should congratulate the folks at Boeing for finally getting their CST-100 Starliner capsule on its first planned unmanned test flight to the International Space Station. Of course, during the years of delay that have elapsed since they were originally expected to do that, a certain complication has arisen. You see, the Atlas V launch vehicle they've been using uses Russian-made rocket engines. Oh well. Incidentally, I have here the January-February 2022 issue of The Baffler, which is unsurprisingly, one might even say ritualistically, opposed to space travel. So much so that they've made it the theme of their issue, and printed an essay by a historian of the Atlantic slave trade, and all I can think is, Heinlein covered that ground in Logic of Empire 70 years ago. But I'm sorry to say there's a certain subclass of intellectuals for whom the narrowing of perspective is a positive virtue. For anyone who is interested, I have got the video extracted from the Wolf Creek Nuclear Generating Station 20th Anniversary DVD I was talking about last time, and that is now posted on Tubnix for your viewing enjoyment on the Man and Atom channel. There's even a song at the end. So, of course, when I read that gray wolves had been returned to the endangered species list in the United States, because of the strange enthusiasm some segments of our society show for hunting wolves, I couldn't help but think, wolves got nukes! It's a pity the Black Fox Station in Oklahoma never got built. And I feel I ought to mention that, to the consternation of many, but certainly to my gratification, the Japanese government has finally agreed that the decontaminated water being held in storage tanks at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear station site should be released into the Pacific Ocean. Now, I say decontaminated for a reason. This is demineralized water, folks. Everything except hydrogen and oxygen has been stripped out of it. Yes, some of that hydrogen is radioactive in the form of tritium. But storing 1.4 million cubic meters of water while you wait for tritium to decay makes no sense whatsoever. In fact, it's already killed at least one person who fell off one of the tanks and broke his neck. No, tritium, as everybody knows or should know, is produced constantly in the upper atmosphere of the Earth by the action of cosmic rays. And so all the surface waters of the Earth contain tritium. The only water you'll ever drink that doesn't comes from deep underground wells. Release this tritiated water into the Pacific Ocean, and firstly, the currents will rapidly cause it to mix with other water, reducing the concentration of tritium to something closer to the natural background level. And secondly, because it is hydrogen, water molecules exchange hydrogen atoms with each other, so tritium diffuses in water faster than the bulk mixing of the water or even the diffusion of the water molecules themselves, which is pretty fascinating. Anyway, between that rapid dilution down to the natural background level, and the fact that tritium has a very short biological half-life, that is to say, if you drink tritiated water, unless you keep drinking it, the tritium will leave your body almost as rapidly as it arrived, by the usual routes, and the fact that the beta radiation of tritium is very low energy. The biological hazard potential is considered extraordinarily low, so the environmental consequences of discharging this water can be reliably estimated as essentially zero. In fact, the amount of tritium in the storage tanks at Fukushima Daiichi is less than what the Rokkasho-Mura reprocessing plant would be allowed to discharge in the course of an ordinary year's operation. Although I understand the plan would be for Rokkasho, if it ever finally opens, to use evaporation rather than dilution and discharge to the sea. Works out to the same whether you dump it into the sea directly or whether you let it rain out. Anyhow, the International Atomic Energy Agency is going to be monitoring this process in order to provide third-party verification of its utter and complete harmlessness. Because that's the sort of thing people in the nuclear energy field do. Not many other industries that can say anything of the kind. Apropos of the high price of fuel, I found myself writing a letter to the editor of the local newspaper the other day. If you want to hear the editorial which inspired my scathing retort, you can listen to me read it in Friday's Hear Now the Words archive. Now, the Startlegram limits you to 150 words and to one letter every 30 days, which really makes their letters page not all that useful. But here's what I sent anyway. To the editor. The suggestion that high gasoline prices can be alleviated by more oil drilling is naive at best. Drilling costs more and yields less now than ever before. The vast debts accumulated in the course of the shale boom have mostly been discharged in bankruptcy, not paid back. Drillers need higher prices. Not only motor fuel, but cars themselves have become ever more difficult for the ordinary household to afford. Better public transit can alleviate both these burdens. And as for our energy supply, what could be better than fuel we have already paid for? There is more energy locked up in America's stocks of spent nuclear fuel and depleted uranium than in the entire world's fossil fuel reserves. You sometimes hear people remark of some public figure, "He just says what everyone is thinking." Well, I hope nobody ever says that about me. If you do, it's not good value for money. I'm supposed to be saying things that you didn't necessarily think of already, things that'll make you think. I'll mention that I saw a very interesting piece from the CBC talking about the causes and effects of the very rapid price escalation of diesel fuel in particular. When there's a price surge, it hits diesel worse than gasoline because more diesel fuel is what you'd call non-discretionary consumption. Gasoline is mostly used for light-duty vehicles, and people can, to some extent at least, make fewer trips, carpool, etc. Whereas diesel is used for trucks and trains that have to move, and, as the CBC pointed out, also farm tractors. So the price escalation in diesel fuel has to be considered when we think about alleviating the global food supply problem, which has come in the wake of this invasion of Ukraine by Russia. Speaking of which, reports are that the Russian forces, not content with crimes against humanity, such as destroying the Antonov 225 airplane, which was, to be frank, not particularly useful for anything, but a true work of art, have attacked the National Center for Plant Genetic Resources at the Plant Production Institute in Kharkiv, one of the world's greatest seed banks. Further information indicates that the destruction was limited, but even still, that is a crime against life itself. But only what is to be expected in the course of war, which is the greatest of all crimes, and the parent of innumerable others. Anyhow, this CBC report made me think. Some people would say, we need battery electric farm tractors. But that's not something anyone is tooled up to produce, and it would require a lot of individual farmers to invest what is, for each of them, a very significant chunk of capital, which they might have difficulty raising. Others might say, well, they should use biofuels produced on their own farms. And certainly, if you run a soybean production operation and can press soybean oil on your farm and use it to run your diesel tractor, that's much less objectionable than most biofuels proposals. But let's look for some lower-hanging fruit. Rail transport is something that is very readily electrified. If we were to initiate a crash program to electrify the main transcontinental lines of the US and Canadian railways, that's a small number of entities which can make large borrowings in the major capital markets. Utility power electrification can be done quite rapidly, and there's no shortage of electric locomotives, especially because existing diesel-electric road locomotives can be equipped with pantographs and rectifier kits so that they can run under their own power in sections which haven't yet been electrified. And the really marvelous thing is that electrification tends to improve on-time performance and capacity of rail lines. Why? Well, one reason is that electrified trains can maintain speed on upgrades. They aren't limited by the power they produce on board. Another reason is that because they don't produce exhaust fumes, they can be put through tunnels at more frequent intervals. As a matter of fact, in the days of steam, when you had to stop and change locomotives every so often anyway, tunnel electrifications were common. But nowadays, a diesel can run coast to coast, and so dieselization resulted in the de-electrification of divisions, particularly in the Pacific Northwest, where there was considerable hydropower available. Of course, another way to improve the capacity of our railroads is to eliminate the unit coal trains. Every time I see one of those things, I have to think that every single car represents 100 tons that didn't have to be dug out, doesn't have to be burned and dumped into our atmosphere, but people have decided they'd rather have that than the oh-so-scary nuclear power plants. Faw. Another observation the CBC made was that there have been large exportations of diesel fuel from North America to South America, because, of course, South America is heading into the winter now, which is the season of minimum hydroelectric production. In normal years, they would use more gas and less diesel, but this is far from being a normal year. When people talk about the global South or what have you, the thing that comes to my mind is the fact that, of well over 400 civil nuclear electric generating units in the world, 7 are in the Southern Hemisphere. 2 at Coburg in South Africa, near Cape Town. 2 at Atucha in Argentina, 1 at Embalse in Argentina, all 3 of those are heavy water reactors, and then 2 PWRs at Angra dos Reis in Brazil. Of course, many countries, such as Sweden or Ontario, have found that nuclear, with its relatively high capital cost and low cost of generation, pairs very well with hydro. That was the concept behind the Washington Public Power Supply System's nuclear power plan in the 70s. Of course, they paid for 6 reactors and only got 1 in the end. Colossal fiasco. But Columbia Nuclear Generating Station is vital to the power supply in the Pacific Northwest. And as I've said before, if Trojan were still running, the power picture up there would be much improved, and it would be much easier to look for solutions to deal with the effect on fisheries of all those hydro dams. Now, as you know, I have asked on this program before for $1 billion so that I can go to the moon to live there. You might be cautious about trusting me with such a large sum of money all at once, so here's another proposal. How about $100 million? I figure that's probably more or less what it will cost to get the NS Savannah out of the cold, dead hands of the United States Maritime Administration, have the ship cut in half, the obsolete PWR nuclear unit removed, hopefully it can go to a museum, and a nuclear gas turbine unit installed instead, so that the Savannah can be returned to her original purpose of visiting ports and countries around the world as a showcase for the peaceful uses of nuclear energy. If you aid me in this, I pledge to live aboard for the rest of my earthly life, which is to say, until I can get on that spaceship. And I'll remind you that the Savannah is outfitted to carry about 100 passengers, in considerable comfort. So if, as a condition of staking this grand venture, you want to join me for a while in going around the world, why, that shouldn't pose any problem at all. Now, if you're new here and don't yet know how this works, you might be asking yourself, why? Because, my friends, The world needs atoms for peace now as much as it ever has. And I don't just mean practically, I mean psychologically. I'm afraid that my country, which, like it or not, plays a leading role in the world, is every day becoming more and more a death cult. We've got massacres streamed live on Twitch. We've got human sacrifice on Reddit. I don't know any other way to describe the pride that's taken in the cryptocurrency subreddits in the suicides they inspire. I happened to be somewhere the other day, and there was a radio on, and I couldn't figure out what I was listening to. Was it some bizarre kind of sermon? It turned out to be a commercial for a gun dealer on a country music radio station. But friends, some 18-year-old picks up a gun and drives to a supermarket to kill black people because the internet has told him there's a conspiracy to replace the white race? Now, don't get me wrong. There has always been an apocalyptic strain in American life. In fact, it's been plausibly suggested that part of the reason the American Civil War came when it did involves the prophecies of the Millerites that the world would end in 1858, which really primed people for a grand struggle between the forces of good and evil. But today, in addition to the usual religious suspects, we have people preaching secular apocalypses. Everything from climate change to the singularity, and the kind of response that elicits in an environment where there's already a lot of social tension for economic and other reasons, is one which America can ill afford, and, to be perfectly blunt, the world can't afford the effect it has on America. I'm honestly beginning to be afraid that if Vladimir Putin doesn't make good on his threat to use nuclear weapons, a president of the United States will. Not this one, I don't think, but he's not going to be around forever. It has been pointed out that a serious crash, for example, in cryptocurrencies, could lead to a lot of highly radicalized people. That's a historical pattern. People's imaginary wealth goes away and they get really angry. And that's what makes me say that we need atoms for peace. The world needs to see, the world needs palpable evidence right up in their faces that the most powerful forces unleashed by or even known to science, forces which they may have been taught to associate with death and destruction on a global scale, are in fact at work making their lives and their world better, and could do far more. That is how we defeat the apocalypticists and the doomsayers and the death cultists. That is why we need atoms for peace. Now, I think some folks last time may have gotten the idea that I'm not a big fan of solar energy, that in fact I have some kind of a grudge against it. While that's not exactly fair, I do see how people can get that impression. My complaint is less against solar energy itself, and more against the people who promote it, because they leave out several material facts, and altogether give a false impression. With solar, you don't get what you pay for. It imposes costs on other people, and the people it benefits other than you, the householder who can afford solar, are people you should probably take a second look at. You know, it's funny. I was reading in the Wall Street Journal a sob story about how Habeck, the new German energy minister, when he came into office a few months ago, was shocked and appalled to find gambling in his establishment. No, I'm sorry. To realize that Germany's energy strategy was burn Russian gas. I could have told him that, and I don't even live there, though I've spent quite a bit of time there in recent years. I don't even really speak German. So I find it very difficult to believe he didn't know that going in. Everybody knows it. Except for the people who've told me, oh no, Germany's 100% solar now. Literally had someone tell me that. To my face, in person. The thing is that solar is not a solution for big cities or heavy industries, and it encourages people to ignore the need for such solutions. It's very, very common to hear, we don't need nuclear because we've got solar, and very similar sentiments. Of course, if you go back to the 70s, it was, we don't want nuclear, we want solar. Just as bad, in my opinion. The feed-in tariff schemes, which have encouraged photovoltaic installations, have discouraged one of the most valuable uses of solar, which is rooftop water heaters. Water heaters use a lot less raw materials and energy to produce than PV, and the heat that they collect can easily be stored for several hours. So you don't have the problem of grid destabilization, which comes when there's a lot of PV on a power system. Now, what do I mean by grid destabilization? All you really have to understand is that solar is so variable that if you have a target of getting, say, 10% of your kilowatt hours over the course of a year in your whole power system from solar, it will happen from time to time that solar generation exceeds 100% of the load on the system, typically for brief periods. Now, this causes multiple problems. Home PV systems are, of course, connected to pole transformers, which are connected to neighborhood substations, and so on. Most of those things don't really function in the normal way when they're trying to send power from the low voltage level to the high voltage level. As long as your PV system is not trying to backdrive the grid, as long as it's only substituting for what you would consume, you don't cause that problem. There are other problems that do arise, particularly with generation having to be idled. Now, if you're in some place like British Columbia, where electricity is predominantly hydro, then that transitory unloading and reloading of the system that happens when the sun comes out and then goes behind a cloud again is much less of a problem, because hydro can be throttled back and then up again quite rapidly. And, in the case of reservoir hydro, the throttling back saves water which can then be let out again later. Of course, the areas of BC where most of the people live are not known for their sunny days. Another complaint that I have about solar systems comes from that variability. And it is that in a conventional power system, there's a strong incentive to minimize demand peaks. The generating equipment typically runs better and more efficiently if you run it at about the same power output all the time. So utilities will traditionally give price breaks for off-peak power use. In some places, this takes the form of what in Britain are called white meter tariffs, where you have two electric meters on your house, one of which can be switched on and off remotely by the utility. What do people use that kind of interruptible power for? Water heating is a common example. Also, big industries, which do three-shift operation, get price breaks for the same reason. But when you have a lot of solar power, it's the other way around. You actually try to produce demand peaks that coincide with the peaks of supply. And this is not exactly harmless, because it does mean that there's a lot of energy-using equipment which is being run only part of the time, which makes it more expensive on a pro rata basis. And also, with the general tendency of intermittent operation, more likely to break down. So that's another place where economic and non-economic costs are driven up. And then there's the related consequence. These large and frequently rapid fluctuations in supply are meat and drink to energy traders, who are a remarkable class of parasites. Now, I thought that we would have been done with these so-called electricity market arrangements after Enron manipulated the energy market in California to take large sums of money for essentially creating blackouts. Somehow they managed to go bankrupt while stealing billions of dollars, which is an amazing accomplishment. But no, these electricity market arrangements have only been extended since that time. To me, it's utter madness. But the excuse given for the existence of these energy traders is that they add resiliency to the market and absorb volatility. I doubt it. Why do I doubt it? Well, you may remember, last week, quite independently of the power outage that happened at my house, for those who may be wondering, the power did come back on after fully 18 hours. I was not impressed. And since then, we've had another power outage. Wednesday morning, this one only about 5 minutes. Not sure what caused that. The system operator, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, ERCOT, was warning people to set their air conditioning thermostats up to 78 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 25 centigrade. Of course, that's about as low as I'd ever want to set mine, except very occasionally to deal with some excess humidity. And not operate their large appliances between 3 and 8 p.m. in order to avoid driving the grid beyond the limits of what could be supplied. Were these energy traders providing resiliency? Reducing volatility? Not so far as I can tell. I think we ought to get rid of them. But the conditions under which they thrive are the conditions of strongly variable supply not correlated with demand. And they find it hardest to survive where generation is reliable and dispatchable. So to the extent that solar feeds these parasites, I resent it. I really do. Another problem is, as I mentioned, that solar systems, PV and wind both, really, in addition to the increased burdens they put on the transmission and distribution network, just require a lot more raw materials and energy than most power production technologies. Just in terms of concrete and steel, they can call for 10 times as much as a nuclear plant of the same output. Now, all that has to be mined somewhere, right? And the energy that goes into producing them has to come from somewhere, and I'm sorry to say that a great deal of it comes from burning coal in very dirty conditions in China, which doesn't seem like a good plan once you remember that the atmosphere engirdles the whole Earth. So the result is, again, if you have a target of getting 10% of your total kilowatt hours from solar, the solar installations are going to require as much in the way of raw materials and energy to produce as all the rest of your generation put together, which doesn't seem like a great deal. And of course, there's that fundamental point I keep coming back to, that it's not democratic to have every household supply its own energy, when the result is that the households of the wealthy will be in a much better position to obtain the benefits that come with using energy. I've said before, and I'll say again, grid is good, and self-reliance is a very strange ideal for humans, considering that social behavior is pretty much how we survive in this world, and how we have become the dominant force on Earth. But I thought of a little example the other day. You know, I come from an engineering background, and in science and engineering and technical fields generally, because the real world is extremely complex, we have a tendency to start with what you might call toy systems, which model one or two aspects of a real system in a way that hopefully illuminates the behavior of the real system, gives us some advice as to where we ought to look, what we ought to do. So the toy I was talking about last time was the system consisting entirely of households with solar and storage. But let me give you a different one, one that's really dear to my heart. Now, I must have well over 1,000 books. Why do I have all these books? Well, it's not really because I like having the physical books around. I do, but not that much. It's because I want to have access to them, and this is really the readiest way. But this led me to think, supposing most people have about 1,000 books they want to have access to. In a city of 100,000 people, that would come to 100 million books, which is a lot. On the other hand, there's a lot of overlap between most people's interests. So we can envision that in a city with a lending library with a collection of 1 million books, most people's desire for books is mostly satisfied, so that people only feel the need to actually own privately, say, 10 books, personal favorites or books on really obscure topics. Well, that means only 2 million books to satisfy the needs of 100,000 people, which means there's a lot more resources to go around to do everything else. Literally a 50-fold multiplier effect. Now, your water system, your sewer system, your electric power system, their grid effects just aren't that good. But they shouldn't be discounted either. Thank you for listening. If you want to support me, you can send me money, for example, paypal.me/prometheuslives. You can contribute to my Patreon campaign, patreon.com/publius_reads. But more than anything, I'd just like to hear from you. Send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. As always, A Step Farther Out comes to you through the good offices of the SDF Public Access Unix System. Coming up next is the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe, which airs every day of the year at 1930 UTC on AnonRadio.net.
In the heart of our nation beats the pulse of our time, a monument to progress in the science of mankind, where Eisenhower's vision, like a keeper of the plains, stands watch on the horizon of Kansas fields of grain. Like the wolf that is its namesake, it's part of nature's blend. Like the people there who give it life with dedicated hands. It's Wolf Creek. It's Adams for Peace. It is teamwork and vision, and we proudly speak of this miracle that's not just concrete and steel, but the dreams of the strong will made real.